On this episode of Common Mystics, when a respected entrepreneur dies under mysterious circumstances in 1885, a divided community demands answers. I'm Jennifer James.
I'm Jill Stanley.
We're psychics.
We're sisters.
We are common mystics. We find extraordinary stories in ordinary places. And today's story takes us to Newport, Rhode Island.
Okay, guys. So let me just address the elephant in the room. Jen and I are leaving Providence and we stop in Portsmouth. It's spelled Portsmouth, so it's very confusing, but it's Portsmouth, Rhode Island. So we stop there and we are writing down notes and we know we have a Portsmouth story, but Jennifer found this story out of Newport that I am so excited about and I cannot wait to tell it to you. So that's why we're kind of jumping the gun and this one is out of Newport, Rhode Island. Okay, Jen, please remind everyone where we were and what our intentions are.
We were headed from Providence through Portsmouth to Newport, Rhode Island, and our intention was, as it always is, to find a verifiable story previously unknown to us that allowed us to give voice to the voiceless. So that was our intention to the spirits as we drove around Rhode Island.
Okay, so now we're in Portsmouth, and Jennifer has this crazy experience in this little itty-bitty cemetery that we just stopped and found on the side of the road. Jen, tell us.
Jill pulls over and the two of us get out and we're in this adorable little cemetery and it's beautiful. And she's right next to me and I'm being pulled to tombstones that have names like Freeman, Freeborn, and just like free kept jumping out at me. And so I said to Jill, are they black? And I turned to her expecting to see her there. But to my surprise, the person or the presence who was right next to me as I was walking along these graves was not Jill.
Wasn't me.
So that happened.
So while Jennifer was getting her spideys on at a different part of the cemetery, I was feeling a feminine energy. I felt as if this woman was speaking in my head, and it was so authentic and genuine. And it wasn't the way I talked. It felt like a third party having a conversation with me. It felt like she was amused by how excited Jennifer and I were about Portsmouth and literally said to me, oh, you ain't seen nothing yet. Because we were excited about all the historical homes in the area and being able to see large bodies of water, the ports from like the cemetery. And it was cute because she was like, oh, honey, you're not even at the best part yet. And we felt pulled to Newport. So I'm like, Jen, I feel like the spirit's telling us go to Newport. And Jen's like, me too. So we get in the car and what do?
Well, you actually said that you felt like Maria Von Trapp in the bus to her first job, like yeah, in the movie Sound of Music. Like we had that energy, like, oh my gosh. And we were almost like singing, like, I have confidence. You know what I mean? Like,
what's weird is that I know nothing about Newport, Rhode Island at this point. Nothing. And nothing. I actually thought it was going to be like more industry, like more like an industrial town than it is. So I know nothing, but yet I'm so excited and giddy to get there.
And when we get there, we are overwhelmed with the quaint, historic charm of Newport. We were walking along almost in a daze, and it felt like we were on a movie set.
I did feel oxygen deprived. I felt like, really did, like my head was a little off. And that woman's energy was so strong.
It was still with us.
It was still with us. And to me, it felt like I was coming home to Newport. Mm. Not just like I was bringing her home, but I felt the excitement of being home. Again, never been there before in my life.
Mm-hmm. She was almost like our spirit guide showing us around. And one of the places that I was drawn to was the jailhouse, the old jailhouse, which is not an inn. And so we took pictures of that, and that felt really significant.
Yeah, it's an inn now. So note to self, we should go back there. I want to sleep in that building.
Oh,
anyway,
definitely.
We are being guided around by this lovely spirit, and we end up at a cemetery. And when I say cemetery, I don't mean like itty little bitty cemetery. This is a huge compound of cemeteries. It looks like one huge quarter mile of a cemetery, if not a full-on square mile. It was called the Common Burying Ground Cemetery, but we didn't know at the time that that cemetery was actually a network of cemeteries. So we approached and walked in from Warren Street, and what I was feeling, because it was huge, it was overwhelming. As a matter of fact, when I walked through the threshold, the woman's spirit said to me, "I know it's overwhelming, just go through it." Like literally, she's like, "Calm down, you can do it, just, you know, the focus." So I kind of settled myself in and I grounded myself and I knew we had to get to the northwest corner of the cemetery. Hell if I know how to get there, but that's where we were supposed to go. So Jen and I are meandering through the graves trying to get to the northwest cemetery. But what happens, Jen?
We weren't able to get there because it was November and it was really cold. And then there was a fence between us and the northern part of the cemetery. So we eventually just said, you know what, we need to call this quits. But there was another reason we stopped.
What was scary is as Jennifer and I are assessing, can we jump over this fence? Do we have to get out of here and walk around to get to the other parts of the cemetery? I heard in my head, and it sounded anxious, which is a totally different vibe that this energy was giving me, right? Because she's been happy, excited. She was home now. And then all of a sudden she got anxious and she said, "Okay, you got your story. Now go. I don't want him to know that you're digging around." Mm-hmm. And so I was like, "Okay, this is what I heard." And she's like, "Well, let's go." Jennifer's like, "Well, we're getting the fuck out of here, right?" Like the excerpt is that way.
Right, right.
So, Jen, tell us a little bit about Newport, Rhode Island, and why it is the most charming place ever and why I want to live there.
I love Newport, Rhode Island, and the history is so incredible. It is located on Aquidneck Island on the Narragansett Bay, and it's situated on the southeastern part of the state of Rhode Island in the United States. And Newport is known for its coastal scenery, historic architecture, and it's also known as a summer resort town. It's about 33 miles southeast of Providence, Rhode Island, the capital.
It's a lovely, special place. Literally, it is breathtaking, and every building there is historic. Tell us more.
Now, from its earliest beginnings, Newport has been a hub of diversity. In 1638, the first group of English settlers were led to Aquidneck Island by the extraordinary Anne Hutchinson. She was a woman who was banished from Massachusetts for her strong religious convictions, which opposed Puritan beliefs there.
And she was a little mouthy, like, let's not lie. Like, it wasn't just that she was a little vocal about it. Like, she could have just kept that shit to herself, but she was, like, teaching women about God, saying that she spoke to God, that really rubbed them the wrong way.
I would say that it was a mutual breakup, Anne Hutchinson and the Puritans of Massachusetts.
They consciously uncoupled.
It was like one of those situations where, to use another analogy, they're like, "You're fired." And she's like, "I quit. You know, I didn't want to be here anyway." So she left and founded Rhode Island. And Anne and her group of followers created an agreement with the local indigenous peoples and settled peacefully on Aquidneck Island. And Anne Hutchinson's community established itself in the island's northern part. But within a year, though, her settlement was divided. Led by William Coddington and Nicholas Easton, a faction relocated southward and founded Newport in 1639.
Okay.
Now, the earliest settlers of Newport embraced the concept of separation of church and state, right? They were followers of Anne Hutchinson, who had enough of the Puritans and their BS. So it all came down to that sort of freedom of religion.
I like that.
Me too, Jill.
It's one of the things I value about our country today, Jennifer.
Right. And so Newport became a haven for many diverse religious groups, including Quakers and Jews during the 1700s.
It's so nice that everyone was getting along.
I wouldn't say that everybody was getting along, but I think it was a really unique melting pot or stew. I think the melting pot analogy for the United States has kind of changed over the years because we don't all melt.
And now it's a hearty.
Well, it's like a hearty stew. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Like back in the old days, it was referred to as a melting pot, but that's kind of passé these days because we want all the peas to remain peas. We want the little nuggets of meat to remain meaty.
That's right, Jen. We do.
You don't have to all melt down and you know, amalgamate. No, we can be ourselves and be part of the same stew.
It's beautiful.
It's beautiful. Damn, now I want stew. Okay. The international trade relations of these various groups helped transform Newport into a major Atlantic seaport. And Newport exported products like rum and candles and furniture. And it was also tied to the slave trade. Wah, ugh. Wah. I know, yeah. It was doing so well, but.
Rum, candles, furniture, and then slave trade.
Wah, wah. Now,
that's why America can't have anything nice. Always with the slave trade. Ugh, go on.
Newport was a key player in the move towards revolution and independence because it had strong revolutionary zeal and a history of resisting British control. Now, because of this, it was kind of a target for the British, and they actually occupied Newport from 1776 to 1779.
That's crazy.
And during that time, over half of its population left. Now, this occupation of the British actually crushed the city's economy. It was like it was standing still in time because there was no industry being developed.
That is a really effective way to protest. Like, screw the tea, throwing in the harbor, being like, you know what? We're just going to leave. You want it here? Mm. We're going to go.
So then after the revolution in the early 1800s, the city moved to reinvent itself because it had no industry left. So instead, it embraced its picturesque beauty and transformed itself into a summer resort location. And it started to attract visitors. And eventually, it emerged as a hub for a distinguished circle of artists, writers, scientists, educators, architects, theologians, and landscape designers. Everybody who was anybody was going to Newport in the summer.
I don't think of like a prestigious
landscapers.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, what?
I know they had me up to landscapers, but I didn't want to like insult anybody. All of the landscapers who are listening, we really appreciate your work and we know that you are true artists.
That's very fair. I'm just saying we could have just left landscapers right off that list.
We could have stopped at theologians. Yeah.
Anyway. They wouldn't know they were left off the list. Do you think a landscaper is going to email us, be like, by the way, ladies, landscapers were a big part of the economy in Rhode Island?
They actually were, but we'll move on. Now, okay. During the later half of the 19th century, there was the onset of what is known as the Gilded Age. And the Gilded Age in America was marked by rapid economic growth and industrial growth. And then with that, people were becoming really rich and spending their money on opulent displays of wealth. And so we saw affluent urban families like the King family, the Griswold family, and eventually the Vanderbilts flocking to Newport for their summer retreats.
I love it.
And these families, among others, played pivotal roles in elevating Newport to an esteemed status as the, quote, queen of the resorts, leading to the construction of the opulent mansions that have since become synonymous with Newport's fame.
I love it. So, Jennifer, it was during the Gilded Age that our story takes place. Bring us there. Tell me about the mysterious death of one very notable citizen, Benjamin Burton.
Oh, Jill.
I'm ready.
I'm so excited to tell you about Benjamin Burton. On the morning of Tuesday, October 6th, 1885, it was a regular busy weekday morning in Newport, Rhode Island, and the streets were bustling with carriages and pedestrians walking to and fro. In the stately house at 63 Levin Street, entrepreneur Benjamin J. Burton was having his breakfast. And suddenly, two gunshots rang out from the Burton home, and moments later, a young Black woman ran out of the house and darted down Levin Street yelling, "Help! Help! My father has shot himself!" Mm-mm-mm. Now, people on the streets were alarmed. They rushed into the house, and another young woman pointed them to the kitchen in the back, wailing, "Father has killed himself! Go get somebody!" And they found 59-year-old Benjamin Burton sprawled on the floor beneath the breakfast table. There was a pistol on the floor next to him. Now, a delivery man who had abandoned his carriage on the street crouched next to Benjamin and felt his wrist for a pulse. Sadly, he shook his head towards the crowd gathered in the kitchen. Benjamin Burton was dead. Someone grabbed a beat officer off the street who called for the medical examiner and the coroner. Now, the medical examiner examined the body and noted two bullet wounds, one to the back of the head above the right ear and one to the left side of the chest. He also noted a large piece of unchewed pastry in Benjamin's mouth.
That's not right.
Now, the coroner got to work next to determine the cause of death, and he sought out the family members to question them. He found them huddled together in a bedroom on the upper floor of the house. Maria Burton Dorsey was Benjamin's 24-year-old daughter. She was the woman who had rushed out of the house for help after the gunshots had rung out. And she said that she had not been in the main house during the incident, but she had been in the attached related living quarters, or the tenement building adjacent to the house. She said that she had heard the shots and entered the main house to investigate when she found her father.
I'm a little suspicious. It's a little suspect to me that she just goes full on saying that her father killed himself. She wasn't there to see him shoot himself. And he had food in his mouth and he was shot how many times? That don't make sense to me. It's drawing a conclusion. Wouldn't you just be like, "Help, my father's shot. Get somebody." Anyway, go on.
Okay. Well, Maria wasn't the only one home at the time of the death. Maria's husband of 3 months, Alan Dorsey, was also there, and he was questioned by the coroner as well. And he told the coroner that he was ill and had been upstairs in bed at the time of the shooting. Now, he said he heard the gunshots, but he assumed them to be the sound of doors slamming, and so he wasn't alarmed. Now, Benjamin's 18-year-old daughter, Emmy, was also home at the time. And she said that she had been upstairs, but she never heard the shots at all. And she had come downstairs only after hearing her sister exclaiming in the street. Now, each of them, Maria, her husband, Alan, and her sister, Emmy, all said that Benjamin had been hopeless and depressed recently in the weeks leading up to the incident. And they told the coroner that he had said that he would not be alive much longer. Now, after speaking to the family and looking over the body, the coroner was satisfied with his investigation, and he declared Benjamin Burton's death was a result of a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
It seems to me that this coroner did not want extra paperwork because that doesn't make sense. These explanations and alibis are janky as fuck.
They certainly leave questions unanswered, don't they?
They sure do. Now, Jennifer. Yes. Who was Benjamin Burton and how did he get here to these final moments?
I'm so glad you asked. Mm. Benjamin Burton was known as Rhode Island's wealthiest Black businessman. He had an excellent reputation in the city, and he was known for his kindness and friendliness and cheerful personality, as well as his quick wit. Now, Benjamin Burton was born in New London, Connecticut, around 1823, and he came from very humble beginnings. He started working in Newport as a teamster doing grunt work. He had a very large physique and was exceptionally strong. He hauled coal and goods from the docks at Newport. And he married Rosanna Babcock sometime before 1848. And they were married for over 30 years and had 7 children together.
He married well, too. Rosanna is a woman of color, and she was a doctor's daughter.
Mm, very nice.
So the two of them found each other. Mm.
I love that match. As the town of Newport grew into a tourist destination for vacationers, Benjamin took the opportunity to create a business that specialized in transporting the luggage and personal belongings of vacationers to and from the docks. And his was the very first Black-owned express and transfer business in Newport. So, Jill, he took the least desirable jobs, often arriving at the docks in the wee hours of the morning to pick up or drop off loads.
Another thing is when I was combing through the old archive newspapers, he put ads in the paper saying that he'd even move the pianos if you had them.
Oh.
I just thought it was cute.
It was well known that Benjamin Burton would take jobs that his competitors would not take.
Mm.
So as Burton's business boomed, so did the town of Newport, blossoming into a popular seaside destination for the wealthy. And by the 1870s, tycoons from New York, Boston, and other industrial hubs were flocking to Newport, where they built their summer homes. And Benjamin became a favorite expressman of the Newport elite due to his physical strength, his outgoing personality, and his willingness to take on any job.
I just love him.
I know, I love him too. Now, Benjamin went on to create Newport's public transportation system.
How cool is that?
A busing system involving a line of horse-drawn carriages. His development of mass transportation in Newport enabled the city to expand and prosper because previously undesirable areas were now accessible due to regular transportation options. And so Benjamin Burton's busing system enabled anyone to ride for only 10 cents, which was a relatively small amount. And so he was well-liked and respected by everyone. The wealthy loved him, and the working-class citizens of Newport also loved and respected him.
Yeah, the community, we love him. The community loved him. He was essentially the president of the school board. He was a highly influential and active member of the Union Church. He had strong ethics, obviously very business savvy, and was really active in the community. So these are all great things. Where was the trouble brewing that got him to an early death?
Good question.
By his hands or somebody else's?
Well, there was trouble in Benjamin Burton's household. Well, let's start with his wife. Unfortunately, Benjamin's wife, Rosanna, died in 1881, and this left him a widower who was raising his youngest children alone and running his businesses by himself.
That's terrible, and that's really hard on the whole family.
Right. So if you're thinking about reasons why he might have ended his life, this would have been a reason.
Mm-hmm.
There was another thing, and that was that there was talk that Benjamin was gambling a lot and had a lot of gambling losses. Apparently, he liked to gamble, and those heavy losses would have affected his financial situation and might have cost him embarrassment in the community.
But is that true? I'm calling bullshit on that.
There is some evidence that he did gamble. But the problem with that is that the gambling houses didn't want to give themselves up by talking about that. So there was no evidence. But the other thing was he was flush. I mean, the man gambled and he spent money, but he also made a lot of money. So it wasn't something that we find out later would have like bankrupted him.
Okay. So what else could go on?
Well, most of the trouble, as it turns out, began when his daughter Maria Burton married Alan Dorsey just 3 months before Benjamin's death.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about this Alan Dorsey. What do we know?
Alan Dorsey was an educated man, Jill, and he was actually on track to become one of the first Black surgeons in the United States.
He does sound hot. Go on.
Like his father-in-law, Benjamin, Alan came from humble beginnings. He was from Athens, Pennsylvania, and the son of a barber. But he had worked his way through school, earning money as a waiter in Newport's swanky hotels during the summer season. And he graduated from Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. Now, he met Maria Burton, Benjamin's daughter, in 1877, and they married on June 17th, 1885. That's quite a long courtship.
That is quite a long courtship.
That's 8 years.
I mean, that's a long-ass courtship.
I mean, we don't know if they were engaged the whole time or if they were just casual friends, like they knew of each other. But, I mean, yeah, that would be too long for me.
And in the 1800s, aren't you, like, when you're courting, need to be supervised by people all the time? Like, that, how annoying would that be?
Ugh.
Okay, go on.
Anyway, 3 months later, 3 months after the wedding, at the time of Benjamin's mysterious death, Alan was planning to head back to Pennsylvania to complete his final year of med school at the University of Pennsylvania. I have to tell you, Jill, this was a prestigious school, and Alan was one of only a handful of Black men ever to be admitted in the history of that institution.
That's incredible.
It is. It really says something about Alan.
What a catch.
But, Jill, med school is expensive. And Alan, he was broke.
Well, school's expensive. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. even today, it's expensive, especially them prestigious schools.
Now, Alan had married Maria in June of 1885, and he depended on a generous dowry from Benjamin that would help him pay for med school and help him establish his medical practice after graduation.
Okay, stop it. Now you lost me. He's dating this girl for like 8 years, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden they decide to get married. It's like, wait a second, was he using her? Like, I don't understand.
Well, let's keep going. After the wedding, Alan gave up working as a waiter and enjoyed— He gave up his job as a waiter and enjoyed that summer of 1885 lounging at Benjamin's house and riding around Newport in his father-in-law's carriages.
Wow. So, dude, all of a sudden decides he's just going to stop working after he gets married mm-hmm. and then has a hot girl summer all on his father-in-law's dime.
Yeah, pretty much. That's a pretty big change because remember, he had been working his butt off to get himself through the university and now med school. And all of a sudden, all that stops after he marries Maria.
That's why I'm interested about their courtship because that doesn't seem right to me. Mm-hmm. Those behaviors, there's something janky there, like they're not matching up, but whatever.
Well, he was waiting for that dowry, but Jill—
Did he get the dowry?
He did not. The dowry was never paid.
Plot twist. What? Mm-hmm. What? What?
Okay. So they get married in June 1885. He's expecting to have it before the fall semester starts. Like he's expecting it before September. But at some point between June and October of 1885, Benjamin has a change of heart about his son-in-law.
Fuck yeah, he did, because he thought he was a hardworking, gonna-be future surgeon, and then all of a sudden he's just laying around the house. Yeah, he did. He changed his mind. He was like, what?
And in the months before his death, Benjamin had complained that Alan was nothing more than a, quote, highly educated pauper.
Benjamin dropped some mid-19th century shade on that ass. Yes, he did.
Yes, he did. And he's noticing during these months that not only is Alan not working, but his own household expenses are suddenly going through the roof.
Wow.
Uh-huh. Like more debt is being assigned to the estate. More purchases are being made. Yeah.
Oh. Hang in there, guys. We'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. We are so excited to unveil the first book in our series entitled Common Mystics Present Ghost on the Road Volume 1, Murders and Mysterious Deaths.
It's everything you love about common mystics and more.
It's a retelling of 10 of our favorite stories from our pod with exciting extras.
Extras like souvenirs, what we took away from the experience, and what to know if you go if you decide to travel in our footsteps.
pre-order the Kindle edition now. All other formats of the book will be available for purchase at Amazon.com on July 1st, 2023.
Thanks, guys. Now back to the show.
Okay, so he is a bold freeloader at this point. He has no shame in just not doing anything and charging whatevs to the house.
Now, Benjamin also, on top of this, was growing increasingly concerned based on rumors that his daughter Maria was involved in her husband's financial misdeeds.
Okay, stop. Financial misdeeds is very different than, like, yes, he's a bold freeloader and he's taking advantage. Okay, get it. But financial misdeeds, there's some tea there that you're not telling me.
Do you want to know?
Tell me what, yeah, tell me what Benjamin found out.
Benjamin found out that Alan and Maria had been borrowing money from extended family members and promising to pay it back after the dowry was issued to them.
So embarrassing.
Maria was also telling wild stories to borrow funds. She said that she needed to raise money for a relative who committed a murder and needed to escape the country.
That's a very specific lie. Like, wow, just be like, I had a parking ticket, Maria. Like, she went to the 11 on that.
And one of their cousins who had lent Maria money found that the promissory note, or basically an IOU note, was missing. She had kept it in a locked trunk and someone broke into her trunk and stole this official IOU note from Maria.
You know what this is? This reminds me of the Swope family out of Independence, Missouri. And this is a clear case that sisters ruin everything, just like the sister in Independence, Missouri.
As if we needed another example of how sisters ruin everything. So all of this is going on. And a week, 1 week before his death, Benjamin confronted his daughter, Maria.
Let them have it, Benjamin. Let them have it.
Benjamin confronted his daughter about her and Alan's wrongdoings. And you might imagine it was a loud and heated interaction.
Yeah, it was. Yep.
Maria denied her father's accusations regarding all the lies and all the money that was borrowed under false pretenses. So basically she's like, no, no, daddy, you got it wrong. But Benjamin had had enough lies and deceit. And he banged his fist against the table as he yelled that Maria and Alan had both disgraced him. And he was disgusted that Alan hadn't worked all summer and had been living off Benjamin's estate.
Yes, Benjamin, get it all out. Get it all off your chest. You are not wrong.
It's not healthy to hold that in.
It's a lot.
And then he demanded that Maria and Alan start preparing to leave his household at once without the dowry.
There's the door, bitch.
Yeah, he was so loud. He was banging. He was yelling. The neighbors heard this.
You know the neighbors were like hanging up their laundry being like, oh, you know what I mean? All like their heads out the window walking their dog. So those were the circumstances that led up to Benjamin's death.
Yep.
Can you even imagine the amount of gossip swirling around the situation? You have Maria and Alan acting like completely foolish and just telling lies that are like way like extraordinary lies. And Benjamin just shows up dead all of a sudden.
Yeah, and the community is forming opinions about this apparent suicide. Like everybody has something to say about this.
People were writing op-eds in the local papers about the situation, and even the mayor was commenting about Benjamin's death.
That's right. Newport society was completely polarized by citizens who were taking sides. Those who believed that Benjamin committed suicide and those who insisted that he had been murdered. And everyone, like you said, even from the mayor all the way down, had an opinion on the subject. Now, you know what's interesting about this division in this town is that this disagreement over the cause of death wasn't drawn down lines of race or class. Every group was equally divided on the subject.
Oh, nice. Okay, so this controversy puts pressure mm-hmm. on the local authorities to reopen Benjamin's case. What do we got? What's going on?
It sure does. Well, the attorney general ordered the exhumation and autopsy of Benjamin Burton. Oh, Jill, this is 10 days after his death. Benjamin is exhumed from his grave in the Old North graveyard at 1 a.m. And it must have been a frightful sight. Shall I set the scene for you?
Please.
Several men lifted Benjamin's 250-pound body from its coffin. Using the coffin lid as a table, in the darkness of night, the medical examiner meticulously inspected Benjamin's remains by the eerie glow of lanterns.
That's just creepy.
And the autopsy results found that there were no gunpowder burns present on Benjamin's head. This meant that he was shot in the head from a distance. In other words, he was not holding the gun that shot him in the head. He was probably holding the sweet roll that he had just taken a bite from.
I totally called that.
You did.
If I'm going to commit suicide, God forbid, knock on wood, I'm never going to do it. But if I did, I'm finishing my sweet roll. I'm not going to die mid sweet roll.
Right. You're going to swallow.
Yeah, I'm going to swallow. I'm enjoying the sweet roll. Right. And then I'll do what I got to do.
So there was an inquest then to determine the cause of death and to decide whether or not someone would be charged with a crime. And it took 4 days and 62 witnesses were called to testify.
Oof, that's a lot.
So all of the physicians who testified agreed about the order of the gunshot wounds. It was the heart wound that was the killing shot, Jill.
Okay.
So Benjamin was shot in the head first from a distance and then in the chest. And the testifying physicians also agreed that the first shot, the shot to the head, would have rendered him unconscious. He would not have been able to fire the second shot to the chest that killed him. And this, of course, confirmed that Benjamin Burton had indeed been murdered.
I totally knew that.
You did. Now shut up. The investigation now turned to determine who was responsible for Benjamin's murder. And investigators quickly zeroed in on Maria and her husband.
Abso-friggin-lutely. Right. Way to catch up, guys. Ugh. Anyway, okay, tell me.
Okay, so Benjamin's own sister-in-law testified to a conversation that she had had with Benjamin about Maria and Alan's financial deceit and misdeeds. Okay, so that was out there, everything that he knew they were doing.
Yep. So Aunt Emily was like, this is what was happening. And I had a conversation with my brother-in-law to let him know that that was some bullshit. And she's really making us look foolish in the streets of Newport.
But it wasn't just his sister-in-law who testified. A neighbor who rented Benjamin's attached tenement apartment testified to hearing the brutal argument between Maria and Benjamin just a week before his death. Mm. Now, Maria and Alan, of course, they were questioned as well, and both expressed their innocence. And on the stand, they were so convincing. They were both cool and calm and collected, and their testimonies described the events of the day of the murder and Benjamin's despondent state of mind in the weeks leading up to his death. Now, they were so convincing that even people who previously suspected them of murder changed their minds.
Really? I can't even imagine that.
They were really good liars.
But the circumstances are so clear. Okay, go on. Sorry.
Well, they had reason to be so confident. And that's because they had an incredible supporter.
Who was supporting them that made them so confident?
Maria and Alan Dorsey had the public support of one of the foremost civil rights activists in the country at the time. George Downing was his name. And he was friends with Frederick Douglass, first of all. You know, the Frederick Douglass? Like the original, big shot, everything, civil rights, leader. He might have developed, invented civil rights. I don't know. He's a big deal. George Downing helped develop the first Black labor union in New York City, and he had been a personal friend of Benjamin Burton's.
Mm-mm-mm.
George Downing had also been a staunch advocate of Black civil rights in Newport for years. And having his support gave Alan and Maria a whole lot of credibility. Moreover, George Downing championed Alan Dorsey. He didn't just defend him. He held him up as
a shining example of what any Black youth can accomplish if they put their mind to it.
Pretty much. A medical student at a prestigious university on his way to becoming one of the first Black surgeons in the country. Wow.
Okay, but that, I agree with everything he said, but why are we talking about it in the context of Benjamin's murder? Why are we intertwining that narrative? That's what I'm suspicious. And George Downing, you're his friend. You're Benjamin's friend. That's why I'm really disappointed in you, sir.
It's true. Well, regardless of how people felt, that tactic worked. And in light of all of this support, the authorities refused to identify Maria and Alan as the murderers. Plus, you know, they didn't have any proof. Benjamin Burton's death was found to be the result of two shots fired by, quote, persons unknown.
That's some bullshit.
But Jill, the prosecutor, was a scrappy Irishman named Patrick Galvin, and he would not let this go.
Oh, that makes me so happy. We need a hero. Tell me what Patrick does. Start playing Bonnie Tyler's I Need a Hero.
Love that song. Patrick Galvin combed through the testimonies of all of the witnesses, and he found a discrepancy in the timeline of events that was vital in establishing Maria's alibi. You see, a neighbor said that there had only been about 5 minutes between the time that the gunshots rang out and Maria ran into the street screaming. But Maria said that there had been 20 minutes. Like, that's a big discrepancy.
That's a lot of time.
That's a lot of time to put yourself in another place.
Yeah, to wash your hands.
Galvin questioned Maria's 18-year-old sister, Emmy, about it, which, by the way, brilliant. He doesn't go back to Maria and be like, hey, Maria, there's a discrepancy in your testimony here. Mm-mm-mm. He goes to little sister, Emmy. Remember, Emmy was home, too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Emmy's testimony had originally supported Maria's timeline of the 20 minutes, but after talking with Galvin, she crumbled and revised her statement, and she admitted that there were really only about 5 minutes between the time of the shooting and Maria's screaming performance in the street.
Patrick, you got him on the ropes. You got him on the ropes, Patrick. What next?
And Emmy's revised statement was enough for him to arrest Maria and Alan.
Plot twist.
For not telling the truth on the stand.
Yay, 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 yay. Okay, tell me what happens next.
Okay. Now, 3 days after the arrest of Maria and Alan, Emmy suddenly suffers a lung hemorrhage.
Oh my gosh.
I know, poor little Emmy. She was dying of consumption. So, in light of this, she calls for Galvin, Patrick Galvin, the prosecutor. And she confessed to him that Alan had shot her father at the breakfast table that morning. She also said that Maria had known about the murder plan and that she herself had been the lookout for Alan.
I knew their testimony and their alibis was not right. Like, that shit was not right. I called that from the beginning.
Now, in light of this confession, Maria and Alan were held without bail and the authorities began setting up for a trial. But you ready for another plot twist?
Mm-hmm.
Maria was sick too. She purportedly also had consumption and was ailing. Despite this, she gave birth to a very healthy baby boy in jail in April 1886.
I mean, congratulations on the baby, but...
Mm-hmm. Now, Maria and Alan's criminal trial began in June 1886. And after one particularly long and grueling day at court, Galvin was called to see Maria in jail.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. She had also summoned her pastor. And Maria prayed with her pastor before bearing her soul to Patrick Galvin. She expressed shame and guilt for being involved in her father's murder. And she said that she was prepared to be imprisoned for the rest of her natural life.
Okay, this is a little too late, Maria. Now that you're dying and you have like about a week, you're going to be like, I am prepared to spend the rest of my life in prison. It's like, yeah, that would have been helpful like last year.
In her confession, which lasted 2 hours, Maria described Alan's dark hysteria after hearing that Benjamin would not pay her dowry to him. Alan believed that his dream of becoming a surgeon was over without that dowry money. When Benjamin failed to pay the dowry, Alan became abusive towards Maria. And when the fall semester began and Alan still hadn't received the money from Benjamin, money he needed to pay for med school, he raged desperately and grilled Maria about other ways that they could raise money. Now, she had already begged, borrowed, and stolen from all the family members that she could think of.
We heard.
And that's when she brought up her father's life insurance policy to Alan.
Maria.
And it was after Maria argued with her father that Alan began plotting to kill Benjamin.
Okay. Seriously diabolical.
Mm.
I cannot even. I'm so disgusted with Maria right now.
So on the morning of October 6th, 1885, Alan took Benjamin's own gun from his dresser and ordered Maria to go next door into the tenement apartments. And he told Emmy to be the lookout. And then he crept down the stairs without his shoes on, walked up behind Benjamin, and shot him in the back of the head. Benjamin fell to the floor, and Alan, seeing that his father-in-law was still breathing, fired a second shot into his chest to finish the job. In an ironic twist of fate, Benjamin's life insurance policy had not been kept up to date, and it was worthless.
Oh, my God. So, Jennifer, how does this end?
In the light of Maria's confession, the jury found Alan and Maria Dorsey guilty, and both were sentenced to life in prison. Emmy was also sentenced to life in prison, but she died of consumption only 6 months later and was buried in the state prison cemetery. Maria also died of consumption in prison 2 years later. Her baby had been removed from her custody and adopted by a Newport family who then moved to New York City.
Hmm.
When Alan found out his wife was dying, he asked to see her.
Aw, it sounds like he was probably devastated to know that she wasn't doing well and he wanted to say goodbye and that he loved her.
Well, he actually went to see her for a favor.
Of course he did.
He wanted to know if she wouldn't mind taking the blame for Benjamin's death so that he could apply for a pardon.
Oh, my God.
She said no in very impolite terms. Now, Alan Dorsey served more than 25 years in prison. Apparently, he was pretty healthy. And after several attempts, he did finally receive a pardon, but not until 1912. And after leaving prison, he moved to New York City and worked as a waiter until he died in 1918 at the age of 83. He is buried in a potter's field.
You know, what's ironic about Alan's death, and I was kind of initially angry and annoyed that he was let out of prison, but then to know that he was back busing and being a waiter, and that was the fate he was trying to avoid by marrying Maria.
Yeah.
I feel like that's satisfying. Like, you're still just a waiter. If he would have just waited and worked his ass off that one summer instead of having his hot girl summer, he would have been a surgeon. But instead, he dicked around and with all these shenanigans and was abusive to Maria and then ended up serving 25 years and just going back to the prison of being a waiter.
I know. I love it. It's kind of poetic justice.
It's so Shakespearean.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let's go over our hits, Jennifer.
Oh my gosh. when I was in the cemetery at Portsmouth before we left for Newport, and I was feeling that person next to me that I assumed was you until I looked, I really think that was the spirit of Benjamin Burton next to me. I think he was exuding pride, not only in being free, a free Black man in America in the 1800s, but also being extremely successful, an extremely important and successful entrepreneur and urban developer, period, no matter what his color, no matter what his race.
He was an incredible man. I just love Benjamin. I'm so glad that we got to introduce people to him.
Mm.
I think I was experiencing one of the girls' energies in the cemetery and that we were in Portsmouth and throughout Newport. Who do you think, which one of the girls was speaking with us? Or at least me?
Well, the energy that I was feeling was very youthful, very bubbly. I think it was Emmy, the 18-year-old sister.
I do too. I feel like Emmy got me drunk and was leading me around Newport, like literally. She was so cute. Her energy was such a spark and the enthusiasm and the excitement to be back home and to share with us her home and the things she loved.
And guiding us through her town and showing us everything. What do you think it meant that I was drawn to the old jailhouse?
I think that she was saying, like, I was in jail. We can still be friends, right?
Yeah, but not only her, also her sister Maria and Maria's husband. They were all probably in that jailhouse.
It's a true statement.
Right.
Oh,
tell me about the cemetery.
Yeah, the Newport Common Burying Grounds.
Mm-hmm.
And that energy again was like, don't be overwhelmed. I know it's looking overwhelming, but you just go northwest. Well, Benjamin Burton was buried in what is called the North Burying Ground, which is exactly northwest corner of that complex of cemeteries that we were in.
Shut up. Shut up right now. So if we weren't sure if this was our story, this is a final confirmation. Benjamin Burton himself was pulling us to his grave, or his daughter was bringing
leading
us there.
Us. Mm-hmm. With that other weird experience in that cemetery was that anxiousness being like, you need to go now. Someone's going to figure out that you're digging around in this. What do you make of that?
Oh my gosh, that totally makes sense. That idea that Alan was controlling and abusive in life, that's what I felt in death when her spirit was communicating with us. I believe it was Alan's dark energy that was like, all right.
You're bringing this up again?
Right. Right. Yeah. Stop talking. Stop talking to them.
Yeah, exactly. You talking too much. Mm-hmm. And just to let you know, I feel as if Alan was poisoning Emmy. I don't think she had consumption. I'm just saying.
I know you mentioned that before. That's kind of a curveball right now, Jill. You're bringing up kind of a curveball.
I'm just telling you that. I'm just telling you that. And I'll tell you why. She got sick before they were accused and held for murder. So just saying. I think that he was trying to shut her up because she was the weakest link. And Patrick Gavin knew it.
I don't know if I agree with you because the fact—
Just sit with it. Just sit with it. Just sit with it.
The fact that Maria also died of consumption 2 years into being imprisoned makes me think that Maria really did have consumption. Maria really did have consumption and was not poisoned. And we also know that consumption is very transferable. It's very contagious. So I think the evidence would support that they both had consumption, but Emmy died first of it. But I'm not going to convince you. I can tell. I'm looking at your face and your mouth is open and you want to argue.
I'm just saying that is true for Maria. And that's true, you know, if we have that same logic, we would assume that Alan would have consumption too. Alan didn't have consumption. And Maria gave birth to a healthy baby. She got consumption when she was in jail. She didn't get consumption until after she was already imprisoned. And you know those prisons ain't clean. I'm just saying.
We don't have evidence of all that, but
I'm just telling you my psychic conjecture.
And I disagree. But let's talk about the voiceless. Who do you think is the voiceless?
I think it's Emmy.
You think it's Emmy?
I think it's Emmy. I think Emmy.
How can you be so sure it's Emmy?
Well, first of all, like I just said, she was poisoned, just saying.
Don't agree with that. Continue.
But also, I feel as if she was really pulled into this situation and this power dynamic. She was going up against not only her sister, but her sister's husband. And she felt almost like as a victim and was also imprisoned for her role that really she didn't have any choices in.
I agree with you. I don't think she really had a say in her role. I think she was told to be the lookout, and yeah. I don't think she was part of the plan. And I really do feel for Emmy, and I do believe that she was the sprightly little spirit that was happy to be home and happy to be talking about what happened. But I also feel for Maria, and let me tell you why. I really feel that Maria was an abused woman. And I think that the abuse broke her down and she did things that she would not have done if not for her husband's abuse of her. So I do have a heart for Maria and I think she deserves a voice as well.
You know, normally I would strongly agree with your position on these things, but today I just got to say I don't. They only were married for 3 months. They were dating for 8 years. Mm-hmm. Something was exactly. weird. Yeah, but my point is that like his behavior changed after they got married.
True.
And that means that how much could she have been brainwashed or like English patient or coercive control within that 3 months? Like, I honestly think that Alan was working hard and he was working hard. And he's like, I'm almost there. Now, can we please get married so that I can just chill out and use your dowry to pay for school? But that's not what he wanted. He wanted to never have to work again, in my opinion, just saying.
He wanted to set up a medical practice. That's working. Yeah, but he wanted to go to med school. I wouldn't say that he never wanted to work again.
He never wanted to work again in that same hard manner that built him to that position.
That's true. He didn't want to, right. He didn't want to do grunt work anymore. True.
Right.
But anyway, you know, Maria, I think that Maria was also under her husband's control. But
agree to disagree.
But I mean, Emmy, 100%. I agree with you, except I don't believe he poisoned them.
Oh, he totally poisoned Emmy. He didn't poison Maria. Maria got consumption while she was in jail. But I will say this, the only way that this makes sense, and if I'm going to give any kind of sympathy for Maria, is if I believe that Alan was so smart and so manipulative that for 8 years, he was not only manipulating Maria, but also putting himself in a position to look like a good match for Benjamin's daughter. And then just at that moment, after he's almost done with school, like at the very end, he just decides like, oh no, like everything I worked for right now, we're just going to stop working and get your money to fit. It just doesn't make sense. Something's wrong there. I don't know. He was so close to the end. All it would have took is a couple more seasons of bussing tables.
I know. That the worst decision anyone ever made.
He can't be a complete idiot and a diabolical mastermind as well. Like something's not right. Just saying.
All right. Well, thanks for this talk. I really love Benjamin Burton, by the way. I love him. I love everything about him. What an amazing man.
He reminds me of mom. He has mom energy to me.
He does have mom energy.
Like super sweet, hardworking, likable, charming, but don't let them lose a shit because there will be screaming. There will be fist a pounding. Mm-hmm. Everyone's going to know about it.
All right. You want to tell the people where they can find us?
I would love to. Check us out on our website, commonmystics.net. Follow us on all the socials at Common Mystics Pod. Please share, like, and subscribe. Our numbers are going up and it really propels us forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. This has been a Common Mystics Media production. Editing done by Yokai Audio, Kalamazoo, Michigan.